Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. Before we get into our story, I want to tell you about another story I recently read for the Time Traveler Show. That story is Mousetrap by Andre Norton. It was a thrill to be able to read a story by one of the masters of science fiction. You can check out the story at www.timetravelershow.com. Now, on to our story. It's October, and in the spirit of the month, we're turning our dial to horror with a story written just for All Hallows' Eve. This frightening frequency is the tale of two strangers who meet on a lonely night in a grand old hotel. They're about to learn that sometimes it's better to stay home and weather the storm, and that it's all well and good to go looking for ghosts until you actually find one. Satin Widows by Matt Wallace.
Maggie's a cunt, Paul said. That's the bottom line. I know it's an awful word, but there's just no other way to say it. Sometimes that woman is a real cunt.
Levins just nodded solemnly into his fifth Glenfiddich. Paul was drinking Grand Marnier, Red Label, of course, and twice as many glasses as his companion, whom he'd met only an hour before. They were the only two people drinking alone in the hotel bar, and they both laughed at the phrase double-dickel with equal intensity. Earlier that evening, Paul lost what he'd been referring to for the last 3 weeks as the World Series of Marital Strife. They were three arguments apiece, taking it to seven, and Paul was ahead with,
"What about the time Oren Bryce slipped you the tongue at my office Christmas party, and you let him get away with it?"
But then Maggie made a double play, firing off vivid recollections of a drunken 3 a.m. phone call from Paul's secretary, filled with pornographic claims, and his 6 month bout with erectile dysfunction several years before. That was the game. So he peeled away from their Turtle Creek home in his Infiniti M45, Don Henley's raw chord serenading him until Paul turned off the radio. He ended up downtown, checking into the Adolphus for the night.
"I mean, 30 years ago it was all, you know, Pink Floyd concerts and completely undeserved blowjobs in the kitchen for no reason. I always reciprocated, by the way. And even after we got married and the kids were born, I loved just being with her. But now, she is just so fucking rigid. I can't even talk to her anymore. Every conversation is a fight. Every fight is somehow my fault. I'm sick of it."
"I spoke to Montgomery Clift once." Levins and his whiskey reflection muttered abruptly to each other.
"Excuse me?"
"Montgomery Clift," Levins repeated. "My first high-profile contact. It was 98. June of 98.
"What? A place in the sun, Montgomery Clift? Red River Montgomery Clift?"
"No. Dead as 35-year-old horseshit Montgomery Clift. for a duration of 1 minute and 33.2 seconds in the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, California.
Fortunately, Paul was in a place where it's not hard to accept a stranger's claim of communing with dead Golden Age movie stars.
"What did you talk about?"
he asked.
"Well," Levins drained his glass, "sin and masculinity. I mostly listened to him whine about his manhood."
"Oh, right. He had other sex tendencies. I read that once." "So that's what you do? You're like a ghostbuster? Ghost hunter? Whatever?"
"No, I'm not one of those gimmicky bastards on television. I am a scientist, a researcher, a professor at Columbia University."
"And what are you doing in Dallas? Long way from Columbia."
"Researching. I came to make contact with the White Widow."
"That sounds very spy movie."
"It's a local legend," Levins explained. "They say she haunts this hotel, you see. The specter of a woman in a white satin wedding dress. She's supposed to have died on the night of her honeymoon. Apparently it was something of a shotgun wedding. And the reluctant groom, in an effort to escape the union after their nuptials, mixed arsenic into his new bride's champagne. Then he launched her corpse down an elevator shaft and fled."
"Jesus!"
Paul swirled the amber liquid around the inside of his glass, then used it to drown the moment of sobriety triggered by Levin's tale.
"So, you're a scientist, but you do chase down urban legends?"
"Well, I theorize in my research that spoken lore on a metaphysical level might actually create the phenomenon we traditionally conceptualize as haunting, which is what I'm trying to prove. It's cutting edge, I assure you."
"Oh, I believe you. I believe you. So you're actually going to look for a ghost in this hotel?"
Levins nodded, staring into his now empty glass.
"Can I come?"
Paul asked him, drunk enough to want to.
"Well," Levins hesitated,
or pretended to.
"I usually have a research assistant, as a matter of fact. But he took ill suddenly."
"Good!"
Paul clapped Levins stiffly on the back.
"Let's go!"
"Now?"
"Absolutely."
Paul had the bartender pour him a double, and they set off. An hour later, after picking up a steel case from Levin's room, they were combing the deserted corridors of the Adolphus upper floors.
"I was planning to do this later by myself," Levin said, "and I was also planning to be sober."
"You don't hunt for ghosts sober," Paul chastised,
swinging the professor's case in one hand and swigging from a bottle of champagne he'd had room service bring up in the other.
"Weren't you ever a teenager? And what's that thing in your ear?"
"It's a form of EVP filter."
"EVP?
Electronic voice phenomenon."
"Oh, like that Michael Keaton movie where he talks to his dead wife through the TV."
"Yes, except no television set."
"Gotcha," Paul said.
"I've set up micro-broadcasters in the ducts of these upper floors. They operate on a frequency below normal human range."
"Broadcasting what?"
"The Legend of the White Widow. Weren't you listening in the bar?"
"And the hotel let you do that?"
"Not exactly."
Paul spent the next dozen seconds blinking, in much the same way you toggle the switch on a rusty machine.
"That doesn't sound exactly reputable,"
he finally said.
For a Columbia professor, I mean.
That's exactly what my department head said to me. Before.
Before what?
Never mind.
So you hope this ghost'll hear you talking about her and show up to retort? Is that basically it?
I suppose, but it's more involved than that.
It's delicate, precise work,
Levin said just before he slammed pelvis first into a Louis XV chair and nearly tore down a very nice Flemish tapestry steadying himself. Paul just laughed drunkenly at first, but then somewhere above his cerebral horizon, the alcohol-swollen clouds parted for just a moment, and a shaft of clear thought, stark realization, broke through.
Did you really talk to Montgomery Clift?
He asked Levins, more seriously than any other question he'd asked in the past few hours. Levins stared at him for a long time before answering, squinting at Paul through an invisible fog.
I'll find what I'm looking for, Paul, and I'll prove my theories. You simply have to have a pure belief. That's what my research is all about, you see. Mine creates matter, or at least the illusion of it.
Paul decided it was easier to take another drink than pursue this line of thinking, which was beginning to drag its rusty edges down the center of his brain. He started to ask another question in the wake of a champagne belch, but Levins interrupted him.
Wait,
he said, studying a Star Trek-looking device in his hand.
The elevator. Perfect.
Levins approached it and summoned the car. When the stained wood doors parted, Levins stepped inside and Paul followed mid-gulp. A few moments later, he spied Levins pushing the big red emergency button a split second before the elevator car shuddered and he spilled champagne all over his suit.
What are you doing? Paul asked.
Levins removed a sleek plastic miner's helmet painted black from his case and doffed it. Paul laughed again, laughed even harder when Levins flicked on the light affixed above the helmet's brim. Then he realized what Levins intended, and the thought sobered him.
Wait, he said. You can't seriously be thinking.
Give me a boost, will you? I didn't bring my grapple and pitons.
Grapple? What? You can't climb through that up there. See? There's a little plaque that says exactly that. Do not attempt to open, it says.
You wanted to help,
Levins reminded him. Paul set his bottle down and made a flesh cup of his hands. Levins popped the ceiling's hatch like he'd done it a million times. And a second later, he was wriggling through the top of the elevator. Paul waited.
Levy?
He called through the dark rectangle into what seemed like miles of nothingness beyond.
Levy? Hey! You get stuck? Professor Levins?
There was no answer. Not for a long time. Paul just stood there, staring into what seemed so much like an abyss now. The first sensation was a tingling in his balls. It felt good when the elevator car first started to vibrate, until the velvet shockwaves traveling up his pelvis collided with the bloated ball of fear spit-roasting in the pit of Paul's gut. It turned his stomach inside out, the sharp spasm of his muscles and the tornado of nausea forming there, galvanized by the increasing vibrations all around him. Paul's teeth started chattering. He clamped his jaw shut hard, only to feel them rattle in his gums, aching dully there, the motion sweep slowly through the rest of his cranial cavity, and Paul could feel his brain touching the interior curves of his skull, making his knees buckle, making the world blink in and out of existence. He couldn't see Levins anymore. Levins was gone. Even the echoes of the younger man's screams were just phantom whispers somewhere beyond the darkened doorway above Paul's head. He circled the edges of the open hatch in the elevator ceiling, afraid to stand directly under it. There was nothing but the sway of a fluorescent bulb from its broken fixture, groaning in a rusty, yawing pitch, and making Paul's own shadow dance circles around him, leaping and twirling, mocking. Then a great invisible blade cut the air and white eclipsed the shaft above for a single blinding second like a huge soaring wraith wing. Paul threw himself back against the wall. He could hear her crying, mourning, a feminine yet inhuman sound. Tears shed through hell and reverberated out the other side into the shaft, twisted and amplified. It smashed through the black barrier of the open hatch and thudded down to the elevator floor. Paul almost caved in his shoulder blades, trying to retreat from it. It was just Levin's helmet. The light soldered to the front, dim and broken. The vibration of the car moved it across the floor as if an animal were trapped under the hollow dome. It shivered towards Paul, seeming alive and possessed, and cracked down the center. And yes, every time the loose bulb overhead swung low, it revealed the blood seeping through the division in the helmet's hard plastic. Paul stepped away from the wall and kicked it into the corner. He felt phantom fingertips tickle the nape of his neck. Paul spun around, fast, wild, but their touch spun with him, and he was still alone in the elevator. It brushed at the hot, sticky skin where it prickled, felt something soft and squirmy there for just a moment. What landed on the floor between his loafers looked absurdly like a snowflake at first. Small and pure and sparkling white. Squinting revealed legs. It was a spider, not made of chitin and veins, but of shimmering cloth. Another dropped to the elevator floor beside it, then another, and finally, Paul felt satin touch his hair and earlobes and watched as four more scurried along his shoulders. He looked up just as they began pouring from the open hatch in droves, an albino hailstorm of spiders, spiders made of white satin, scrambling under the cuffs of his sleeves and hem of his pant legs, teeming in his hair like tailored lice. The thought hit him harder than the tactile sensation. He was trapped in a steel coffin suspended 200 feet in a dark shaft with supernatural satin spiders raining down on his head. And then they started scurrying toward his mouth. Paul gagged and retched, regurgitating the first half dozen into Levin's upturned helmet. But they soon filled his throat, incapacitating the muscles there. A moment later, with 1,000 tiny legs pushing through the soft tissue of his lungs, he thought of Maggie, of her pain, and how he'd never be able to apologize to her for everything. At the final stroke of midnight, two elevator doors opened into the lobby of the Adolphus. Waiting to take the ride up was a bellhop, a Browning sales rep in town for one of the city's weekly gun shows, the bass player for a metalcore group called Hateskin, and the underage girl from University Park he'd lured back to the hotel with a backstage pass and a hit of Special K. "About fucking time, man," Hateskin's bass player grumbled into the girl's magenta-striped hair. Her shriek split his eardrum, and he dropped the half-empty bottle of Löwenbräu in his hand. It shattered on the marble floor, the echo rising to join the girl's scream in a nightmare chorus. He was slumped in the corner of the open elevator, the middle-aged man in the disheveled suit. His face was a fleshy roadmap of blood-raised, hardened veins, and his eyeballs were half bulged through their sockets. The smell, more than the sight of him, told the small audience they'd just discovered a corpse. The bellhop was the first one to approach him. He crouched down beside Paul's sprawled legs. He thought the speck of white on the corner of his mouth was spittle or vomit at first, but not the way it shined in the light, solid and shimmering. Satin. The bellhop couldn't help himself. He reached out and grasped the slip of fabric between his gloved fingertips.
"Hey,
Eightskin's bass player said.
I watch CSI, man. You're not supposed to fuck around with the crime scene.
But the bellhop was already drawing it out of Paul's mouth. An unbroken ream of satin. Yards and yards of it. It should have been stained with blood and saliva and undigested food. It should have dragged Paul's stomach lining up through his throat. But it was white. Pure. Virgin white. Enough to make an entire dress out of. And on the end, a single delicate rosette flower, also formed from satin. Later they found Emmanuel Levins, an ex-professor from Columbia, with a history of mental instability, hanging by the neck in the elevator shaft. It was ruled a murder-suicide. The bartender remembered Paul and Levins drinking together. In the years to come, that same bartender would often spy a lone middle-aged figure drowning bitterness and sorrow with a bottle. Just as often he'd take pity on him. He'd say, "You know, I once met a man in your exact situation who met with a foul end." Then he offered them a cup of coffee in the house and a piece of advice. Go home to your wife and make amends. You don't want to end up like that other poor son of a bitch. He's said to haunt the elevator shaft of this very hotel. Thank you for listening to Satin Widows by Matt Wallace and narrated by Rick Stringer. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com and be sure to follow the links to our journal for notes about the production of Variant Frequencies. Thank you. From the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Ann Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
Join me, the Time Traveler, on the Time Traveler Show, where we interview authors and voice actors and then present vintage stories read by a guest reader, where we find tomorrow through yesterday, all at timetravelershow.com, spelled with one L. That's timetravelershow.com. The Nexus, where science fiction meets audio.